Anyways, Glenn Stecklenbeck with us. It's been a long time. It's been about 13 years. He was last on with Art Bell, and we're going to be talking about his incredible work in the presence of extraterrestrial intelligence. His family goes way back investigating this. We'll talk about that, too. Welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Our special guest for the next couple hours, Glenn Steckling. Glenn has assumed the responsibilities in a great way of his family's work in the field of UFO and ET research since his father, the late Fred Steckling, passed away back in 1991. And Fred was at the forefront of UFO research, folks. This knowledge represents years of personal experience and collective data. Now armed with firsthand sightings, he continues to present the materials discovered and bequeathed to his family spanning over 60 years. Mr. Steckling's latest vision and revision to his father's book, Alien Bases on the Moon, now Alien Bases on the Moon 2, contains a combination of more than 100 NASA photographs challenging the continued myth behind the dead moon theory and the fact that it's inhospitable about planets, and exposes the increasing possibility of extraterrestrial activity there. Glenn was a guest of mine on Beyond Belief. We'll talk about that a little bit later on as well. But Glenn, welcome to the program.
Hello, George. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Has it really been 13 years since you were on the radio show?
I don't think so. I think we had a show maybe early 2000s, and it's been a while, but we did a show together after I did one with Art Bell, and of course my father did several with Art.
Yeah, he sure did. And yours with Art was, they tell me, January of 2006.
I don't keep records of my own appearances, but I'll take your word for it.
But I had fun with you on Beyond Belief as well. We'll talk about that a little bit later on.
Okay.
I assume that with your dad being so involved in the study of ufology, and I want to get into how he got into that, you, as a little boy, just came right along with it.
Well, the entire family was immersed in the field, and so, you know, they had had sightings during World War II in Europe, along with so many of the military service personnel on both sides of the conflict. And then when we came to this country, we had a number of sightings in the Colorado Springs area, Aurora. And then the next year in Washington, D.C., over downtown Washington, D.C., one of these bell-shaped crafts at 1,200 feet. And there were about 30 other witnesses, including the reporter for the Washington Daily News. So that article I sent you as an upload, and people can see that as part of the archives. And it describes quite thoroughly the sighting there in Washington.
We've got some great images that Glenn sent us that Alexis posted in the carousel reel at coasttocoastam.com. Your father was right in the middle of Project Blue Book during that era. He was there when George Adamski was doing his thing with his claims. He was there in the infancy of all this, wasn't he?
Well, my father came to the field officially with his meeting with George in June of 1963. George was coming to the East Coast to lecture to the Air Force Reserves, and my father communicated him because of his book, Inside the Spaceships and Flying Saucers Have Landed, and that were found in the Library of Congress, where there were clear photographs of these type of crafts taken by George Adamski through his telescope and camera equipment, and later he took motion picture footage as well. Which we reviewed some of that on your program at Beyond Belief.
Mm-hmm.
And so we became good friends with George and became co-workers, personal co-workers of his and confidants. And he exposed us to close-up sightings and meetings with some of his extraterrestrial friends, which continued on to further on through our lives. And so I can say from the age of six that I have been exposed to this subject and seen these craft and have followed this my entire life. And knowing that my parents were so active during the 60s and 70s and throughout the remaining of the years by going to the Pentagon and NASA and British House of Lords and things like that, there was an immense amount of real activity, tangible interactions with people who didn't joke around about this subject, that didn't find it obtuse or strange. And they had oftentimes a great deal more information, the 22 scientists at NASA, Goddard, and Colonel Freeman and the staff at the Pentagon. This was no strange notion to them. And in fact, Colonel Freeman said by viewing George's films, they're some of the best he has seen in civilian hands.
Wow.
Of course, they had better ones for the military. But in
that
civilian hands, in those times, they were quite outstanding.
Did your father ever tell you, Glenn, what got him hooked into this field?
Well, I think that that being aviation-related, since my grandfather was a pilot during the war, and my father always had flying in his heart, and he didn't do it professionally like I've done, but he did it through his life on the amateur level and loved to fly, loved to look up in the sky. After you've had seatings of these type of craft, he filmed a fleet of them out of the train in Germany in Mannheim in 1966 during his lecture tour, and then a cigar-shaped craft, probably several thousand, estimated about 5,000 feet long, below the 707 as we were traveling across the North Atlantic. And so once you're exposed to this type of truth, a substantial, hardcore fact, then there's no way that you can shake your head and put it aside.
Tell us, if you can, Glenn, about the really immense background that your family had in the field of ufology. Take some time to go through some of these cases and things they studied.
Well, we talked about the sightings in Colorado and then meeting George. And then the Silver Springs film that George took in 1965 was one of his last before he passed away. And my father arranged the international press conference in the Mayflower Hotel at that time. And my mother sent out all the invitations to the press corps and to the diplomatic corps, in which most of them attended. And so they were forefront in the pursuit of this particular field. Now, if you recall from history, Colonel Freeman, along with Donald Kehoe, Major Kehoe was very instrumental with the construction of NICAP, of collecting the thousands and thousands of reports and photographs and presenting them to Congress.
National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena.
That's correct. And he describes quite vividly how he ran into a wall, a stone wall of resistance by government officials, by military officials, such type of silencing that even Admiral Hillenkoetter, who was a former CIA director and part of the board of NICAP, eventually recused himself. And so this time in the 60s, when you had the end of Project Blue Book, the Condon Report, and the hearings in the Senate in 68 with Professor McDonald, it was an immensely active time of trying to get some tangible release of the secrecy that surrounds this subject. And when you read Major Kehoe's book and you see what he's run across, you become to understand why disclosure is the most, restricted type of information that won't be released. You don't go to these types of steps and measures and to propagandize the UFO subject in order to just come clean later on. So once you see the type of obstructions and from the many different angles and facilities and communities that are against releasing this information, and you understand why, then you can understand what transpired during those years. And so progressing into the late 60s and 70s, George Adamski showed us on the map where there was a extraterrestrial landing facility in central Mexico. So we bought a property very close to that area, and we were 3 years down there during that time. And within a week of our showing up, the Mexican military intelligence, their police showed up, and with two trucks full of troops and equipment. And
oh, my.
The commandant was very accommodating, very nice. He came and knocked on the door. My father welcomed everybody with open arms. So come on in. I got nothing to hide. And then they dispersed themselves over the many acres of the ranch and looked with metal rods and magnetometers and all kinds of things. And so my father said to the coming down. He says, well, you know, this makes me very happy. He says, because obviously you wouldn't be out there looking for something if you didn't believe that it didn't exist.
That's right. He bought the right place.
And so the commander pointed to one of George's pictures that was hanging on the wall, and he says, we know they're here. We know they're good for us, but we don't want them.
Wow.
And he went on to say that we have seen an abbreviated file sent from the Pentagon concerning your activities, and my father had seen it too. It was about the size of a New York phone book. And
wow.
So they said to us, you are allowed to stay in this country as long as you don't go amongst the population and hold lectures and try to educate the people, because we do not want any changes to our system, either economically or religiously. And so that was that. And so my father said, sure, that's fine. So we had other work to do. We were doing research with the telescope. And we drove up towards the base and interacted with not the people in the base. That was still a day's hike through the forests away, but with the villagers that lived the closest to that. And they looked at us rather strangely. And my father said to them, well, why do you look at us so strange? He says, well, we've seen the same kind of white people, or, you know, multiple complected people come out of the forest in nice business suits and dresses and things like that, and they walk down the road until they hit the main highway, wait for the bus, and they disappear. But we've never seen anybody return.
Hmm.
And so this was an area at that time upon which there was a landing facility, and it was allowing them to integrate with the people in this country and ours.
Did you find, Glenn, that during that period, or did your father find, that the media took these subjects pretty darn seriously? I mean, I remember in the late 60s, I'm in Detroit, J. Allen Hynek is in Michigan, where he said swamp gas, and he was forced to say that, I'm told.
Yes, that's true. In fact, I have the article in archives where he rescinded his opposition to UFOs, and he was holding one of George Adamski's photos while he did it. And my father, you know, corresponded with everybody, the White House and Hynek and all these people, and he sent him a letter, and he sent him photographs, and he said to him, you know, in case you find the swamp gas solidifies into solid metallic crafts like the ones in these pictures, you know, let me know. And so, you know, and to a certain extent, these people were initial mouthpieces for the disclaiming of this subject. I mean, the Condon Report right then and there was constructed out of Enfeso and its own chapter.
They were the disinformation people, and they never stopped.
Well, that's true, and that's true. And they gave to some degree, they gave the people what they wanted to hear, and the assurance that, you know, this wasn't an issue and they didn't have to worry about it. You know, and then, you know, you see pieces of film like the Dakota film in 67, which they're launching their rocket, we're launching our missile, and the ship is flying around it in circles, shooting laser beams at the warhead, disarming it. And, when you look at the outstanding accumulation of documentation and photographs and motion picture films from the 1940s on, no one in their right minds could possibly claim that this phenomenon does not exist. When you look at the official release by the Obama administration, it's almost comical. Everybody had such high hopes that those people would give up information, and they had no intention. And to some degree, they don't even have access. The last presidents to have true access were Eisenhower, Kennedy, and somewhat Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
Adamski took Eisenhower into the desert of 58 and to one of our bases where one of these craft landed, and he did the same thing for John Kennedy in 1962, and George carried a White House access card that allowed him access into the administration. They knew who he was. They knew his contacts were real, and he supplied them with a great deal of photographic evidence in order to accumulate their files and understanding, and he said it was very simple. These people lead our country. We need these leaders who have their hand on the atomic button to know what is real and what is not, so they don't do something reactionary and cause great chaos and destruction. So like anywhere else, if you're coming to a world or to a country or community, you look for the leaders of that particular situation and address them first until you find out with a great deal of disappointment that we're not willing to, you know, further that, and then you have to go amongst the people, which, and that's what they did with George and many other people.
Well, that's absolutely true. Is the story true, have you heard, that Richard Nixon, while president, took Jackie Gleason to the Homestead Air Force Base and showed him an extraterrestrial?
I've heard that story. I don't know whether... I have never heard anything where that was stored at Homestead. I know that the recovery of not only Roswell, but several other crashes, so to speak...
Went to Wright-Patterson.
Went to first through Dallas and then to Wright-Patt. And I understand there was one body or two that was kept in cold storage in Walter Reed. And I know that several presidents went to that facility in order to see the bodies. But I have no idea, I have nothing that has ever confirmed that anything was at Homestead. And it could be very well that, like many of these things, there's a portion of truth to it and then a portion of misdirection, so that people don't get too close, and then, you know, like Area 51, they start storming the place thinking they're going to find something that is not there to begin with.
You're still the director of the Adamski Foundation, right?
Yeah, well, that's correct. Yes, I took up those responsibilities officially when my father passed away in 91, and alongside my mother and other co-workers. My late mother passed away 2 years ago. And so I take care of the facilitating the Adamski Foundation and Space Voyager LLC, which I've incorporated to put it all in one neat little package.
How did the media during Adamski's day treat him?
Well, I mean, like anything else, you have, like today, you have some media that treats things kind of objectively and honestly, and other ones who are going to go the status quo of rejection and ridicule. During those days, I found that the articles, and some of them I've sent you as uploads as well, I mean, you found front-page articles, L.A. Times and many other newspapers, of sightings of these crafts, UFO sighting over the hydrogen bomb tests, 200-foot craft over Texas. I mean, there's really such an incredible amount of wealth of information. And so the media tended to be a little bit less constrained in those days, although not totally. I remember a good friend of my father's was an editor for an East Coast paper, and over the ticker tape, while he was sitting in the office, came a UFO report of a landing and three students being taken up for a ride, and the editor says, "Here, you keep it. I can't print this. I've been told, you know, that this starts to fall now under national security." I think the belt's starting to tighten with Lyndon Johnson, and then since that time it has tightened to the point where...
Well, was it national security they were concerned about, or were they putting these stories in the woo-woo file?
Well, there were both. You know, first of all, since the middle 60s, they tried so hard, the Condon Report, to negate the whole thing and to just brush it under the rug and hope people would become, well, we had Vietnam, we had other things, and the riots in the streets and
sure.
The burning and of our cities. There were other things that were forefront in our minds, front and center. And so, you know, they just shuffled that as far deep as they could. And so, like I said, some facilities treated it a little bit more objectively, and then others, you know, just put it in the National Enquirer kind of
basket. Glenn, hold on. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back and talk more about your family's incredible work in the past and what you're doing right now in the present. And we'll take your calls next hour with Glenn Steckling as we talk about UFOs. Fascinating. Much more to talk with him about when we come back in a moment. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you. Glenn Steckling with us. We'll take calls with Glenn next hour. Glenn, back in 1967, there was a briefing with a Dr. Lohmann and 22 scientists at NASA's Goddard Space Center. Tell us about that. And I assume that was your father who was participating in that?
Yes. Dr. Lohmann and NASA Goddard sent out the invitation. My father, my mother, and another lady by the name of Madeline Rotifer went to this briefing. There were 22 scientists. They looked at George's pictures. They knew all about them already. They knew of the construct of the craft. They knew how the electromagnetic energy worked, a free energy that propelled them and they were aware of the type of human pilots that were piloting them as well. Some of the conversation had to do with how many people from other planets are visiting us at any given period of time, and my father wrote down a number, and the scientist wrote down his number, and they exchanged pieces of paper, and they were practically the same number. So
wow.
They were satisfied that they were getting the real thing, information-wise and contact-wise. And, of course, that gives people something to think about, that these people walk amongst us, so they look just like you and I, and they're not pulling off a funny rubber mask and looking like a reptile underneath. This is all Hollywood science fiction garbage. This is a type of atrophying this field has turned into over the many decades. And so, once again, these people were serious. They knew the information. They had inside information. And so those contacts developed into the 70s, upon which my father and our family started to order the first-generation copies from Apollo and from the Lunar Orbiter programs. And we got those copies via microfilm and Fish, and eventually the prints themselves, 18 by 15 Hasselblad pictures from Apollo, that shows the activity on the moon. It shows, of course, our craft going to the moon. This notion that we never went to the moon is ludicrously funny. And it's another one of these examples of misdirection in order to convolute and cloud this entire subject. When you look at Mercury and Gemini, all of this preparation for the space program and the spacewalks by Ed White and so forth, by the time we got to Apollo 11 and went to and 10 and shot to the moon, you know, ground-based telescopes followed the mission the entire distance, both professional and amateur, across the entire planet. And so you have, you know, tens of thousands of people who witnessed this craft going from Earth orbit and going through space and going to the moon. You have pictures from the 200-inch Hale Observatory telescope up here in Mount Palomar of the landing site and the Sea of Tranquility and the equipment that was left in the crater, including the later Apollo missions with the lunar rover sitting there and left on the ground. And you look at the pictures, and some of them I sent you as well, of the moon in orbit with the lunar module from the LEM, and you see Earthrise coming over the moon in a series of shots in which you can see the surface of the moon, the atmosphere, change in color and in density as the Earth comes up and the light reflects off of that. So we found for our research that went in the book Alien Bases and the Moon that the moon has atmosphere, and in some areas more than others, gravity about 60% of Earth. And when you start to understand this, all these notions that become invented by those who have no idea what they're talking about, why is the flag waving when the astronaut jumps away from it and then back to it to hold it? It's because you have a certain amount of lunar atmosphere. You have about 2.5 pounds PSI pressure in the Sea of Tranquility. And so there was motion. And you have mists, you have clouds. The lunar chronological collection by NASA from 1966 clearly depicts all these events of lights moving on the surface, flashing lights, clouds, mists, spraying geysers. And so when you begin to understand the facts of what actually the conditions are on the moon, it easily explains why things happen, why astronaut Young with a 250-pound pack can only jump 2 feet in the air, because he's got almost 60-some% gravity of Earth, and he's got all that weight on him. And when you watch the lunar rover and it moves around and the dust particles trail behind the tires and slowly settle back onto the lunar surface, that's because there's not a vacuum. There's atmospheric pressure. That's the only way those particles can be drawn back to the surface. And when you look in more recent times, the crashes of both the Israeli and the Indian probe on the moon, it is because, at least in my opinion, they don't realize or didn't realize at that time, because there's not a whole lot of shared information from space agencies between governments, that with the higher lunar gravity, they had to have more fuel for retrofire in order to put this craft safely on the surface. And they simply ran out of gas and then was pulled by gravity into the lunar surface and crashed. And so, once again, you know, it's a sad state of affairs when ignorance leads to wild theorization and supposition, when the facts are pretty easy to find for most people if they really want to look. And so we find that commonality in conditions on the moon, as we do in other planets in the solar system. And I sent you a couple of uplinks, so, you know, the Mars half covered with snow.
Yep.
And then the Mariner 10 shot of Venus, which shows clouds and blue planet underneath and polar ice caps when they tell you it's 800 degrees Celsius. So, you know, we told a lot of misinformation, and it's up to us to ferret through it.
Going back to Adamski for a second, then I want to talk about the old Art Linkletter show, but why was it Adamski? Why was he selected by these ETs?
Well, it had to be somebody. I mean, if it would have been, you know, John Smith, and somebody would say, well, why was it John Smith? In George's case, he had already done a great deal of teaching and lecturing already in the 1930s, having to do with the universal concept of life through the cosmos and the commonality of the human genome. And our scientists later on, many, many decades later, Cyril Ponampour, who ran the Maryland Chemical Laboratory, who wrote The Principle of Life, said the very same thing. Now, don't be surprised when you land on another planet and you walk out and somebody's there to shake your hand. And because they are common principles for construct, whether that's exobiology or a biological chemistry or astrochemistry, and we've discovered that the molecules combine the same place, the same way. They come from space in the same manner and seed the planets. And that's true whether you're on this world, on another world in the solar system, or across the universe. There are principles of creation and nature because that's not haphazard. They don't operate. It doesn't operate by the chaos principle our own minds do. And so George taught about this already then. He already had his first telescope in 38. He took pictures already there in between 38 and 40 and submitted it to government, and they were non-responsive, and a year later we were in World War II, so they had other priorities. And so George continued to follow the subject and take pictures, and that led to the meeting in Desert Center out there on November 20th of 1952, which is documented. Even the military, who was on maneuvers, and this is in Project Blue Book, reported that they too had seen a UFO over Desert Center at the same time George Adamski reported it, and it was in the Phoenix Gazette and the Oceanside Blade reported as well. And so he seemed like a natural pick. There are other people around the planet who had similar sightings, of the Dobbinshire Coniston photos. There were two girls, twin sisters in Norway, lady in South Africa. Father Renier down there in Argentina spoke, he ran the observatory down there. He spoke very vividly about this. Father Gill in Papua New Guinea in Australia, along with his students, saw a craft hovering there with people standing outside on the edge of the craft on the flange working on it, and they were waving to them, and they waved back. And so, once again, the multitude of reports and sightings. In George's case, he just was the most motivated to get out amongst the people and to inform and provide the material, most of the times, you know, completely free of charge, to whomever was interested. And he thought that this was our natural step in evolution, to go out into space, to interact with our extraterrestrial visitors, and to move our planet away from war and disease and hunger and these type of activities that we like to continue to this day, because it spurs our economy and stock markets and these type of things.
Glenn, did he ever talk about the Valiant Thor, that so-called person from Venus?
Well, my father, after George passed away in April of 65, at the end of the year, towards November, there's a knock on the door, and my dad and I opened the door, and we stand there, and there stands Valiant Thor. And my father starts laughing. And Val starts laughing. And my father says, I know who you are. You're a misinformation agent for the Pentagon sent out to cause confusion and mayhem.
Uh-huh.
And Valiant Thor, laughing, says, yeah, you're absolutely right.
So he was real, but he wasn't from Venus.
Oh, he was not from any other planet than this one right here.
Whoa.
And he was one of a multitude of people who were sent out as agents into cause as much mayhem and misinformation and confusion as possible. And my father said to him, well, I know enough extraterrestrials. I know you sure as hell aren't one. And Val says, no, that's true, I'm not. And so my dad says, well, you know, you're not going to get any traction here, so, you know, go on your way. And Val said, okay, we'll see ya. And off he went. And so that was our one and only encounter with Val Thor. But, you know, there were other people that the so-called Yamsky debacle out of England, I believe it was, and some others. And, you know, there at any one time, there was it was documented that when George was giving lectures, there were people who were around the world claiming to be him saying the exact opposite. And so it was a good thing that he had George had a very good network of witnesses and recordings. People made recordings when he spoke, and so he was able to refute, you know, that. But that was a common tactic in those times. The Men in Black came to him in the early 50s and said, you know, if you don't cease and desist, we'll tie you to the bumper of the car and drag you down the mountain. And George laughed at him, and he picked up the phone and he called the commandant down there in San Diego, and says, you know, your agents came up here to threaten me, and if you do this nonsense again, I'll reveal their names and the departments they work for, and it'll be on the front page of the media. And so they said, okay, we'll leave you alone.
And what about what about the Art Linkletter show? What happened there, Glenn?
Well, in 1970, my father got on a plane and left Mexico and went to Art Linkletter and was on the show, and he was also talking about his first book, Why Are They Here? Spaceships from Other Worlds. And so this was one of the immediate events. And of course, Linkletter was known for decades. You know, other people have been on these types of shows. I remember Gordon Cooper was on with Merv Griffin.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, oh, yeah, absolutely. I've seen these ships. I've seen their human occupants. They come from planets in the solar system. He was quite straightforward about it. And several astronauts have, as well as, you know, the late Dr. Edgar Mitchell as well.
Linkletter and Ed Sullivan, they were the two top shows in those days.
That's absolutely. And there was also Mike Wallace. I remember my father and my mother and Madeline went to.
When he was on 60 Minutes? Even before that?
I think it was before that, mid-60s, she and Madeline went to.
How about Edward R. Murrow?
Well, of course, everybody knows the name. From our generation, at least.
Yeah.
But, you know, these people like Hudley and Brinkley and Morrow and
Cronkite.
And John Chancellor and these people, Cronkite, you know, they were all the stables of the journalistic and news system when you got news and not somebody's rampant opinion. Now you can't turn a cable network or news station on without them ranting and raving their opinion.
That's right.
I don't want to hear that. I want to hear the news.
Things have changed. Let's talk about the book, Alien Bases on the Moon, and the updated version as well. Tell us about that overall premise.
Yeah, the book contains about 120 NASA pictures in there from the catalogs, very activities, clouds, vehicles moving along the surface, mining activities, and it has a plethora of information concerning the gravity of the moon, and how that's calculated to be 60% versus 1/6. And so that book came out in 81, which resulted in Lord Clancarty inviting Dad to go to the House of Lords Select Committee and present that material. That was forwarded both to Prince Charles and to Prince Philip, which he received acknowledgement. I have that in my archives. And, of course, what a lot of people don't know is that Lord Mountbatten, who was the brother of Prince Philip, he had an estate in Ireland, and one of these crafts landed in the early 70s. And so this is not by far the only notable, you know, group of people, whether it's the royal family there. George went and talked to Queen Juliana in the Netherlands. He received the Golden Medal of Honor from Pope John the 23rd for delivering a sealed message to the Vatican from the space people. And so, you know, every government, every religious denomination, all have had exposure to this material. And so when you realize that, then you can understand the great amount of suppression that is occurring.
Oh, my God, yeah, absolutely. I mean, and you're convinced, beyond a shadow of a doubt, of course, that we're being visited, we have been visited. Is there some kind of relationship between government and the ETs?
No, there's no clandestine. I've heard this accusation, too, that they have, you know, had this little powwow and they agreed them to give them, you know,
abductees and technology.
For genetic material. I mean, all of this is a bunch of nonsense. First of all, these people are living and experiencing a technology that's 3,000-4,000 years ahead of ours. To travel space successfully is an immense technology. It's not warp speed, Scotty, and go wherever you want. When you go into space, you are totally immersed in a three-dimensional star field. And pointing yourself at something doesn't mean that's how you get there at all, because we do not have the ability to travel at speeds that allows that. What most people don't understand is the Earth spins at 1,000 miles an hour. Everything in orbit is 17,000 miles an hour. But the planet and the sun moves through space at 1.3 million miles an hour. And then space itself is moving. That's why I find it always so incredulous that people are hanging on to the notion that the stars and zodiac symbols are going to determine the outcome of their life and existence and experiences, because the light they see in the sky now was generated millions of years ago. And in the time it's taken that light to get there, those celestial bodies have moved millions upon billions of miles into a different direction. And so we are easily fooled by the notion of our sense versus the reality of the science.
Glenn, we're going to come back and take phone calls with you and continue chatting about your family's incredible work in the field of ufology. Glenn's website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We'll be back in a moment.